Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
What's it like for you watching games of your son coaching?
Agonizing.
It's a family affair on Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast.
You know, I didn't know there was actual work here.
Recent guests include Rich Eisen, John Harbaugh, Judge Judy, and John Madden.
I thought one of the greatest jobs in coaching in the NFL was Jim's first year with the 49ers.
Exclusively on Podcast One Sportsnet. Get episodes every Tuesday on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts.
Great time to be a Wolverine.
Welcome to Real Gem Radio. I am Daniel Wu, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. Before the playoffs, had talked with Kevin Pelton of ESPN about an idea for talking about the early part of the playoffs that he liked and ended up, I don't know if he had it before I did or we were talking about at the same time, doing something similar with a piece, so it really tied together. But what we wanted to do was talk about all eight series at the two-game mark. It's one of the rare points where everybody's at the same place in terms of number of games played. So this was recorded on Thursday afternoon. It was before, obviously, the events of Thursday night's Game 3s in three series. But I think the conversation holds up really well. Really fun dive into a lot of the different dynamics that are going on in these series. And it is brought to you by Simple Contacts. They have this amazing 5-minute vision test that you can do, and you can also go to simplecontacts.com/realgm or use the RealGM promo code for $30 off your contact order, which is fantastic. And then our friends at TrueCar, great place to buy new and used cars. The conversation with Mr. Pelton goes a little bit over an hour. I think you'll really enjoy it. I love talking with him, and here it is. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks as always for having me.
I enjoy the idea, and you and I talked about this, I think even before the playoffs started, about doing something after all the game twos, because I do feel like we have a significant amount more information now. It's not necessarily clarity on a lot of these series, but I do think we have more information than after a really fun weekend of game ones.
Yeah, and it's also a nice dividing line, because I think after this point, you're going to see some series that maybe even get to game four before game three, depending on the schedule, but certainly those happen on the same day next weekend. But here it is, all eight series are at exactly the same point at the same time.
And I had been wondering how to kind of frame this discussion earlier. And then this morning when I woke up, I saw your piece, which ranked the series in terms of competitiveness, which I thought was an interesting way to organize this. And then I realized, oh, that's the perfect way for us to talk about these series, because the fact of the matter is, and sorry to those fans of teams that are later in this, but we'll talk more about the more competitive series, I would assume.
It makes sense to do. That was definitely the way it ended up in the piece. And yeah, we were searching for a frame to write this piece at, you know, obviously the same time between game two and game three. And I thought that made the most sense. And then did it kind of subjectively instead of going by any of the projections that are out there.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense. And what it led to was, because I thought about it as soon as, because I saw your tweet and I'm like, okay, where would I go with this? And I thought about it for a couple minutes before I started reading the piece, and I was pleased that we went with the same number one, and that's Cavs-Pacers, which I absolutely would not have expected before this started, but think is the right call given what we've seen so far.
Yeah, I think there was two options here, the other one being the Jazz and Thunder, who we'll get to in a second here, but yeah, before the series, it's interesting. What I did beforehand is a preview of all eight series, was ranked them in terms of the projected likelihood of an upset based on the model that I use to project playoff series that takes into account the team's point differential during the regular season and then the head-to-head record of the two teams during the regular season. And largely because of the fact that the Pacers won 3 out of 4 head-to-head matchups, and were the only lower-seeded team to do so, this was ranked as by far the most likely series to produce an upset, and is close to a 50-50 matchup overall. And I kind of dismissed that a little going in because, you know, first off, all of those matchups occurred before the trade deadline. I think Isaiah Thomas played in several of them. And then there's also the knowledge that we have that, you know, there's a playoff gear for LeBron James, and more so than any other teams, his teams have tended to play better in the playoffs. But so far, we saw playoff LeBron last night in game two, and the Cavs needed it just to eke out a victory at home.
Yeah, and in some ways for me, it was easier to write off for, like, you know, the idea of being concerned about the Cavs. It was easier to write off game one, which they lost going away, than it was to write off game two, which they won, because so many things went right for Cleveland early. LeBron just going off, and it wasn't just LeBron getting to the basket every single time. If that was the case, you know, you could deal with that. And I think he will have moments like that in the series, though Bogdanovich has defended him well. This was LeBron James hitting a bunch of jump shots. He was 2 of 5 from three, but I think he was 7 of 9 from mid-range. And you can't bet on that every single game. And so then Victor Oladipo picked up the early two fouls, the second of which I quibbled with. And then he picked up a third foul in the second quarter and missed a bunch of time there. And it's not so much, oh, well, in plus minus, the Pacers were better than the Cavs when Victor Oladipo played. It's not the statistical part of it. It's when you watch it. The fundamental question in this series for me was, can the Pacers outscore the Cavs? And when Victor Oladipo's on the floor, the answer to that question is yes, a lot more than I thought it would be.
Yeah, and I mean, we knew that the Cavaliers' defense was going to struggle because it's the Cavaliers' defense. And they've just had no solution for Oladipo. He's become the master at, you know, when he gets a switch in pick and roll and then goes into an isolation situation, you know, a lot of guys will back up a little bit to create some more space, but he's going way back and kind of creating a runway for him. If you don't follow him out there, I mean, if you do follow him out there, you're in trouble. But if you don't follow him out there, he's going to be at full speed by the time you're trying to make your first step. And that is incredibly difficult to deal with.
Well, yeah, and there was that play, I think it was Jeff Green, that Oladipo just completely crossed him over and got all the way to the basket, but then DeMontis Sabonis missed the three-pointer. But Cleveland, in their current iteration, and this is actually part of the argument, even though he's imperfect, that I would use to say maybe Tristan Thompson should get a shot. Not like, oh, he should start or play heavy rotation minutes, yet he would have to earn it. But Cleveland just does not have a ton of deterrence other than LeBron when he's active. And LeBron is, you know, he can play that center field role a fair amount, but he hasn't been as dominant at this season as he was, you know, especially in 2016. But they just don't have that many other capable help defenders. They have some guys who can maybe get in the way. And the Pacers, part of how they were such an effective shooting team this year is not the idea of, okay, they have Steph Curry and Klay Thompson or something like that, and those guys are going to take a majority of the threes, and those guys are two of the best shooters ever. They've done it by having a lot of competence out there, and that can be harder for a defense because you aren't concentrating that shooting capability, you're dispersing it.
Yeah, and any one breakdown, all right, if we make sure to help to this guy, we're going to be okay. It's you got to help to everyone, and the Cavs have not been very good at doing that. I think to me, one of the most interesting strategic matchups in this series is, you know, where Miles Turner has played defensively. Game, you don't want him matched up ideally with Kevin Love because that's a really tough ask for him. He doesn't defend particularly well out on the perimeter. His instinct is to be, like many big men, is to stay around the basket and be able to protect the rim there. In game one, he was able to do that quite readily because of the fact that he was hiding on Jeff Green. Game two, Ty Lue changes his starting lineup, gets more shooting in there with Kyle Korver, and J.R. Smith takes that option away. So he starts out on Love, but then in the second half, fascinatingly, is defending George Hill.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting too, and it made some sense, especially because George Hill was more passive in this game. I thought that was a pretty significant disappointment for me. I've been a big believer in George Hill basically forever, but it was the right move tactically. I mean, of imperfect options, that is the best one for Miles Turner. And also, you saw the relief, let's put it, in the Pacers' defense when Larry Nance was on the floor. That does not mean Larry Nance is a bad player. It just means that he doesn't provide that spacing that Cleveland's offense can really benefit from.
Yeah, the geometry makes more sense for Indiana defensively because you know that Nance is going to be either in the pick and roll or around the basket, and those are places that Miles Turner is used to be.
So one of the other elements that changed in this series in that second half, I mean, you brought up the Miles Turner element, and I think that we'll probably see that in some iteration, largely because it worked and because Jeff Green is going to probably be marginalized even like he was. He only played 13 minutes a game too.
Yeah, but he basically played exclusively, it looked like, as LeBron's backup at power forward, which makes sense.
It does. And we'll have to see. Brian Windhorst, I believe, was the first to report that Kevin Love has a partially torn ligament in his left thumb. And something that I have become more aware or cognizant of since the last couple of years is the idea of the nuance that is a player playing but not being 100% and the impact of that. And that's what I'm concerned about for Cleveland. Thumbs are an incredibly important part of basketball. I mean, even though it's on his offhand, Love does a lot, you know, as a shooter, as a rebounder, and any limitation there, if it's being heavily wrapped or if it's just pure discomfort, is a big problem for them, not only because Love is a gifted offensive player and he's a capable defensive rebounder, which can be very important for them as well, but because there is not another player on this Cleveland Cavaliers roster at the moment that can really replicate what he does, either as a big or a small. I guess the closest you could come is just using one of their perimeter players like Rodney Hood more, but they don't have enough depth outside of that to really make that work for full games if Love can be less, if he's less effective.
Yeah, I spent some time contemplating what they would do lineup-wise if he was unable to go entirely before we got the report that, you know, he would likely play in Game 3. And, yeah, I think that was the conclusion, is that they would just probably end up going small a lot more because, I you know, as much as you might like the idea of Tristan Thompson, I just don't think he's going to play a big role in this series. So, yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. Larry Nance provides them a different element when he's in there, but it is, again, makes things much easier for Indiana defensively.
Something that's worth watching in this series is just, I think overall, Indiana has outplayed Cleveland in the two games of the series. Both games were in Cleveland, and now they go home. And Indiana, it's not like they're some neophyte playoff team. These guys have been in it before, though it is sometimes confusing because the organization has been in a lot more recently than these specific players because of the, you know, the Paul George teams, which are largely disbanded at this point. So will they get a boost from their home crowd? Or my current theory on this is I don't think this series swings as much with that as other things do, though Cleveland has been inconsistent and lost some surprising road games this year.
LeBron and his teams historically have been pretty impervious to going on the road, you know, in almost any situations. I mean, you think back to the conference finals that they've started without home court advantage and just looked completely comfortable there. So, yeah, I don't think that specifically is going to be an issue. It's just going to more be the continued matchups of can the Cavaliers get enough defense to win this series.
Do you think there's anything that they're particularly doing wrong on Victor Oladipo, or is he just a terrible matchup for them?
Yeah, I don't know. I have a good idea for an alternative solution.
Yeah, I don't either. And in certain ways, it's actually more challenging for Cleveland to face a two-guard that is really talented offensively than a three, which is the exact opposite for almost every other team in the NBA, just because you can't really throw. LeBron tried to guard him that one possession, and Oladipo relished driving by him and getting that layup past him. So I still think LeBron is capable of handling that for stretches of time, but if he's going to be playing 40 minutes a game, he's basically now the primary ball handler on almost every possession that he's on the floor, really running the show, creating a lot, not only for others, but for himself, that it's too much to ask for him to do that game in, game out, maybe for crunch time minutes like that. And I think the Pacers can counter it because there isn't anybody else that's really any better.
Right. I mean, I guess I did maybe expect more trapping from Cleveland in this series, since that's usually been a Ty Lue staple in the past.
Yeah, I think we'll see more of that too. And they need to be really disciplined about it. This is something that came up. Maybe we'll talk about it in the Portland New Orleans section, but you have to get a trap in the right place where you're actually narrowing the options, because if everybody knows you're trapping early, then you can do a couple of different things. You can short it. You can just make an early pass. You can kind of fake a pick and roll. And I don't think Cleveland's communication and their defensive instincts are sophisticated enough at this point to handle that sort of nuance. That said, I'm not sure the Pacers are really situated to create that more on the fly, because we just haven't seen them deal with it that much this year.
Yeah, I mean, historically, their answer to Oladipo getting trapped has been, Oladipo, dribble your way out of this.
Right. Kevin and I have seven more series to talk about, but I want to take a quick moment to tell you about Simple Contacts. Simple Contacts is a company that really impressed me, because what they've done is they have taken something that has been a really arduous process for a long time, even with many of the developments that we've had in terms of technology, and made it simpler, made it more convenient and more accessible. And really what you can do, the most amazing distillation of it, is that if you are looking to renew your contact prescription, you can do a 5-minute vision test from either your computer, which is the way I tried it out, or your phone, which is simply incredible to me. And that vision test gets reviewed by a licensed doctor. You can get a renewed 1-year prescription, and you can reorder your contacts. And if you have an unexpired prescription, you can just upload a photo or your doctor's information, and you can order your lenses that way. So it's a truly incredible process. The vision test, I've done it. It's self-guided. It takes less than 5 minutes, and it is really reviewed. I actually had, they caught a problem, not with my eyes, but a problem with the way I administered my vision test, and so they had me correct it. They wanted to make sure that everything was right, and I was blown away by how sophisticated the process was. It's designed by doctors, and licensed ophthalmologists review every test to make sure that your eyes look healthy and that your vision has not changed. Simple Contacts also, of course, offers all the brands of lenses that you're familiar with, and they have great customer service. You can get text updates, everything like that. And beyond the convenience of being able to do this from your phone or your computer, the vision test is only $20, and it can be so much more expensive if you have to go into a doctor, and also time consuming. And time is money for a lot of people as well. So you have all of these things running together. So you can check it out. I definitely recommend that you do. You can go either, you can use a URL or a promo code. I love it when they do both, because then you can do it either way. The website is simplecontacts.com/RealGM. RealGM Radio, you're very familiar with that in the show. And if you do that, you get $30 off your contacts. Or if you have trouble remembering the website address, you can just enter the promo code RealGM at checkout and you get the same $30 discount. It's pretty awesome that you can do it that way. Definitely check it out. Vision test is amazing. I was really impressed by the technology. And again, that's simplecontacts.com/RealGM or the RealGM promo code, RealGM. You can check it out. This is not a replacement for your periodic eye health exam, but it is a truly remarkable process. Simple Contacts, vision care simplified. So we can move on to the second series in terms of competitiveness for you. And you mentioned this at the beginning, that it was really a two-series race. And the other one is Oklahoma City against Utah. We're recording this on Thursday afternoon. That game, like Cleveland's, was Wednesday night. And I think this ties in with the other part of why this series is so interesting, is because it's harder in this series to say than in the other one, but also Oklahoma City doesn't have LeBron James, that you could make an argument that Utah has either outplayed or been close to it with Oklahoma City in these first two games, though I would say Oklahoma City played pretty dang well in the first game.
Yeah, I mean, Utah, it's an interesting position, because as well as they played in game two, there also was a sense when this was kind of tied midway through the fourth quarter, like, oh boy, if they don't get this one, you know, you go home down 0-2, you're in a pretty big hole. As much as people like to say that cliche that, oh, the series doesn't win until a team wins on the road, like, no. The fact is, and I think John Hollinger back in the day did a really excellent job of making this very clear, if you're the lower-seeded team and you go into Game 5 tied 2-2, you're in trouble because of the fact that now you have to either win Game 5 or Game 7 to win the series on the road. You only have two chances to get that road win you're going to need, and Game 7 has been so difficult for road teams to win historically that now Game 5 is close to a must-win for you. So really want to be in position to have a chance to take one of the first two on the road, and that's where I think it was important that Utah pulled out that win Wednesday night.
And they pulled out that win through defense. And Oklahoma City, sure, they missed a bunch of shots in that late game. I think they scored 13 points in the, or it was something like 18 points in the final 13 minutes of that game. Some of that was Oklahoma City missing shots they normally make. Melo had a couple wide open threes. Westbrook had a pull up two. But overall, I thought not only just in that stretch, but before that, especially when they were able to prevent the Thunder from getting into transition, I thought Utah did a much better job in game two of challenging the shots that Oklahoma City wanted to take. And Paul George was key in that. They were getting into his body more, making him dribble more. And I don't think he's going to shoot 4 of 12 from 3 every game, but I do think Utah's defense played a major part in that.
I mean, that may be a more sustainable percentage for him going forward than the 8 of 11 he shot in game one.
True.
Yeah, I thought, you know, we know this is an excellent defensive team. So it was surprising, I think, that Oklahoma City was able to have so much success offensively in game one, and a little disconcerting. But that also was driven largely by that three-point shooting by Paul George. And when that came back to earth, we saw more of what we've come to know and love about the Utah defense. And what I thought was most interesting from a strategic standpoint in game two was their ability to keep Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert both on the floor late in this game. Early on, you had Jeremy Grant, you know, kind of playing alongside Melo and Steven Adams in the front court. And so it was pretty easy to use Grant as a hiding place for Derek Favors. Then later they went back to Corey Brewer in that spot and didn't have Adams in at the end after he fouled out. So it was a little more nominally difficult, but it's still Oklahoma City just doesn't have enough shooting in those spots to really make Utah pay for playing traditional bigs.
And in the first half of this game, Derek Favors was able to kind of return the favor and take advantage on the offensive glass. I think he had 6 offensive rebounds in the first half and 8 total. And that's something Melo, you know, he has strengths as a player. And I don't think that posting Melo up is a good idea. But if you have both Favors and Gobert, or just situationally whoever's around, crashing the offensive glass, as long as it's not Jay Crowder, who did that way too much, you don't sacrifice
or
as much.
Or Ricky Rubio, who did it in the fourth quarter. And
Oh, God, that's right. Yeah. And so there is an advantage to create against Oklahoma City, who has talented players, but you know, generally speaking, if you were to really draw the lines, they are playing smaller a portion of the time. I mean, they don't really have a backup center, something that was very noticeable in this game. And Steven Adams, you know, I thought he played well when he was out there, but you could see I'm not completely sure whether it's a wrist, a hand issue, or both, but you could see him being affected by it. I still think he played well. I thought that if he had stayed in the fourth quarter, if he hadn't fouled out, that this game could have gone very differently. But outside of Adams, who is I would say is a better offensive rebounder than defensive rebounder, because he focuses more on box outs, but they just don't have that many other guys. You know, Patterson can try a little bit. Jeremy Grant is a good vertical athlete, but he doesn't really have that wide base. And so sending 2 capable guys at the rim is probably going to produce more offensive opportunities than you would expect otherwise.
Yeah, particularly against that second unit. And we've known that was going to be a weakness going back to when they traded Enes Kanter, you know, in the Melo trade before training camp. And they've done a pretty good job of mitigating it most of the year. Jeremy Grant has played excellent for them. And, you know, they were good overall when he was on the court in this game. But to me, you know, a lot of this series is going to continue to hinge. This was something I posted about, I think, at the end of the third quarter. What happens in the minutes where Russell Westbrook is on the bench? Because last year in the playoffs, the Thunder just got destroyed when Westbrook was on the bench. That's the reason they lost the series. The team had a positive plus minus with him on the court, and I think 3 out of the 5 games in a 5-game series loss to the Rockets. That was how bad they were when Westbrook rested. And, you know, nominally, you pick up Paul George, you pick up Carmelo Anthony. A big part of what you're trying to do is make sure that you have scoring for those situations that Westbrook is not on the court. And it didn't really translate during the regular season. It actually seemed like they kind of played better when they just threw 5 reserves out there and let Raymond Felton run the show. Game 1, they were positive in the minutes Westbrook sat. That was a big factor in them winning. Game 2, first half, or the third quarter, they started out pretty well. They extended their lead with Westbrook on the bench when he first went there. But then the Jazz went on a run. Donovan Mitchell, I think, had like the first 5 points of the fourth quarter. And they ended up, I think, a -2 in the minutes Westbrook missed. So if the Jazz can continue to win those minutes and play relatively even when the starters are on the floor, then they're in pretty good shape, I think.
And I've been pleasantly surprised with Dante Exum's play I was pleasantly surprised with his play after he returned from injury as well, but I thought Felton would give him some problems because Felton, you know, knows what he can do, solid, all that kind of stuff. And it's like, oh, Felton's going to play his game just like they did on those, you know, true second units with Oklahoma City this year. And I think Exum has sped him up a little bit. He's created a few turnovers. He's gotten in there. And I think he gives them, it's not the reason why they've been winning those minutes, but I think he gives them another element which can certainly be useful.
It's just nice to see. This is the Dante Exum that we all kind of expected when, you know, you had him number 1 in your draft board, right?
I did.
So did I. So this is what we were thinking about Dante Exum, and it's nice to finally see it on the court.
Yeah, and I'm very happy. This is a thing that you deal with in the playoffs as an evolving process for talented teams of, okay, who plays and who plays how much? And I think Utah has gotten pretty close now to what their rotation should be. Jarebko, I thought he did generally did a nice job in this game, so his minutes can vacillate a little bit, but, you know, they're going to need to rely on a lot of Donovan Mitchell. Maybe Derek Favors is going to play 37 minutes in every game, but the only bench players they had out there, Jay Crowder, certainly capable, even though I didn't love his play in this game. Royce O'Neal, I thought he did a nice job on Paul George overall, you know, just makes him work. It's not necessarily like, oh, he's going to beat Paul George. That's not the goal. The aforementioned Dante Exum and Jarebko. Yep, that's about right. And the starters played a lot more than the backups, and I thought the backups did pretty well.
The other thing we should probably talk about here, and I'm sure this is something that the Oklahoma City coaching staff is talking about as they think about how this series goes forward, is Ricky Rubio going 5 of 8 from three, which is not something the Jazz can necessarily count on. But the old idea was, boy, you know, Rubio's been this great regular season player, but when you get him into the playoffs, his lack of shooting is just going to kill you because teams are going to willingly help off of him in that setting. And lo and behold, he's become enough of a catch-and-shoot three-point option that now you can't quite do that to him.
And the catch-and-shoot part of that is a problem for Oklahoma City because Russell Westbrook is largely guarding him, and playing against Russell Westbrook will create catch-and-shoot opportunities because he just loses guys. Talented, you know, when he's engaged, but Westbrook just is very spacey defensively. He's been that way almost his entire NBA career. And so Rubio's reluctance to shoot actually did burn Utah a couple times this game. You think, oh my God, he shot 5 of 8 from three. How did that happen? And there were a few plays where, like, he got the ball in the corner and Rubio's going, eh, no, I'll try to do something else with it. But those straight rhythm threes, you know, gets the ball, that's the play, you have to shoot it. He did a really nice job of taking and making those shots in game two.
So the other thing, strategic thing we should probably discuss is, do we think that the Thunder will go to Paul George defending Donovan Mitchell earlier in game three and going forward? Because it wasn't until pretty late that they made that switch. But granted, Mitchell didn't play that well in the first three quarters.
I think they probably should, but it has been noticeable that Joe Ingles basically being out of this series offensively has really changed Utah's offense. It's made them a little bit more vanilla. I love Ingles as a kind of a supporting player, and Paul George can take guys out. And Donovan Mitchell, you know, you talked about Ricky Rubio going 5 for 8 from three. If Rubio and Mitchell go a combined 5 for 15 from three in future games, that's not a big surprise. It's just the apportion, because Mitchell was 0 for 7 on threes, and I think he was 0 for 9 on shots outside the paint overall. But yeah, going to your main point, I think it's more important to take out Mitchell or minimize his impact and let Ingles hit a few more shots and distribute a little bit more, just because Mitchell has proven to be the best engine that the Jazz have. And that's what led to one of my other ideas, which was one of the ways that Oklahoma City could counter, theoretically, Paul George going on Donovan Mitchell, and this wouldn't necessarily take off that matchup, would be a little bit less Ricky Rubio. They could go in a couple different directions. The one that I would support is actually playing Jay Crowder at the three. So go Mitchell, Crowder, Ingles, Favors, Gobert, or, you know, you can, there are a couple other little wrinkles you can throw at it, because they're traditional coaches, and I think Donovan largely aligns with this, would be reluctant to put their point guard on a guy who's small forward sized. And so maybe you can get them to break off that matchup, even though they should.
Yeah, just engineer some weird matchups by going that direction. It's certainly worth a thought. Yeah, to go back to the Rubio-Mitchell point, by the way, they had, like, completely opposite games. Mitchell, excellent in the paint, can't make an outside shot. Rubio shot 5 of 8 of 3 and 1 of 8 on two-point attempts in this game.
Yeah, and I wonder where how the Jazz are going to treat Corey Brewer the rest of this series, because he is really their fifth option offensively. And so how aggressively are they going to handle that? You know, let's say the Favors Melo minutes aren't going as well as the Jazz had them go in game two. I don't think in half court offense, Corey Brewer is going to be this dynamic off ball creator or anything like that. He'll hit some open threes if Favors over helps, but the Jazz have the benefit of Rudy Gobert, and that takes away some of the pressure, desire to overhelp, which is plaguing a bunch of other teams in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, the Thunder offense, unless they have Abrines out there with, you know, the four core players, it's going to offer hiding spots for Derek Favors one way or another.
So your number three series, and again, I agree with this, there are a couple different directions you could go with it, is Sixers Heat, another 1-1 series. And we're recording this before game three of that series happens. But I mean, the thoroughness with which Miami defended Philadelphia in game two was notable. And while, you know, their offense isn't necessarily going to play the way that it did in Game 2. I like that it provided kind of this idea of, okay, this is how Miami can make it a series. And yes, of course, that will change if and when Joel Embiid comes back.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, both teams got substantially worse shot attempts in Game 2. And Miami really had the weaker shot attempts when you look at the average value of them because of the fact that so much of their offense was coming through the mid-range and through Dwayne Wade in particular in the mid-range, a recipe that was not successful during the regular season but worked very well in this game in a game that largely reminded me of that 2016 series between the Heat and the Hornets in the first round.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I'm having trouble figuring out, like, I think with this series, more so than any of the other ones, I have a trouble figuring out, like, where the ebb and flow is going to be. I picked Philly in 7 at the beginning of the series. I could certainly see it going that direction. But in any given game, including the one that's going to happen on Thursday night, I don't feel comfortable going, oh, well, this is going to be, you know, okay, Miami's at home. They were on the road the first two games. This is going to be how it goes. And I think the same thing generally ties in with tactical adjustments in this series.
Yeah, no, the Ersan Ilyasova at center lineups was kind of an unexpected development for me in game one, and it threw the entire series in a different light, I guess I would say, in terms of the floor spacing Philadelphia now was able to create with Embiid out of there and just the different style of the game. And then it could lurch wildly in another direction as soon as Embiid gets cleared. So, yeah, it's hard to see the through line to the way this series is going to go.
One big shift that happened, and I think it worked really well for Miami defensively, was Josh Richardson, I believe, is the Heat's best defensive player, but he's a little bit too small and not a perfect fit on Ben Simmons. And I was very impressed with what Justice Winslow did on Simmons. Fortunate as they were that he could play fewer minutes and thus provide greater intensity. And if Richardson is off Simmons more of the time, that allows him to just wreak havoc on the rest of Philadelphia's offense. And I think that could be a big problem for them, at least until Embiid gets back, but probably even after that point.
He was as good a perimeter shot blocker as we had in the league this season. So, yeah, his size and shot blocking ability created some real issues for Philadelphia. And, you know, I think he was a big part of just – both of those guys were a big part of just the physicality and then the ball pressure that Miami was able to provide that really did seem to throw the Philadelphia offense for a loop in the second quarter in particular. But then you look at it and then the Sixers, I mean, I don't know what the pace was in the second half specifically, but they scored 61 points after halftime. So they did seem to find a way to adjust to it.
They did. And the Sixers have a series of different options that they can go to. I mean, they have guys who are competent 3-point shooters, not necessarily great at creating their own shots just off the dribble, but a lot of different ways they could go. I also thought it was weird to see Markelle Fultz play as little time as he did. I understand that what Brett Brown is doing is he doesn't want Fultz and Simmons to play with each other given their relative limitations. And not only that, but just the ways they succeed is with the ball in their hands. But I feel like maybe you go a little bit more to Fultz and Simmons. We haven't really seen scaling with him. Just, you know, rookie, missed his whole first year with the foot issue. And a challenge with all of these players, especially early in their careers, is figuring out, okay, what is the value added for them for minutes, let's say 35 through 40? And I think we're still evaluating. So I can't say Brett Brown is wrong to rely heavily on Ben Simmons. I'm not saying that at all. But we don't really know yet if he, like, let's say LeBron James, can, if those minutes just reduce the effectiveness of him overall.
You know, it didn't feel to me like they did in the fourth quarter of game two of this one. But yeah, I mean, it is still something we're kind of going through the learning curve with here.
Once Embiid gets back, does Hassan Whiteside basically just go back to more of his normal role because he has a place to be? Or, I mean, I think Kelly Olynyk has played very well in the series. Do you just say, we'll try to make this work?
I think that's going to depend on a few factors. I mean, first off is going to be Whiteside foul trouble. You know, he got into it even without Embiid on the court in game two. And that, you know, as much as the matchup difficulties was a reason he didn't see much playing time. And then, yeah, I think the other question is, do you want to try to combat Embiid's strengths or try to, you know, pull him out on the perimeter with Olynyk and put him in unusual, you know, atypical defensive situations? I think either of those can be effective strategies. And generally, you know, I think I like the Heat better with a Linick at center rather than Whiteside.
I do too, especially because Whiteside, he can be a capable deterrent at the rim, but he's not as reliable as the best guys. It's part of the reason why I never loved the defensive player of the year arguments with him. So the Sixers are running a lot, you know, towards the basket. They're doing all that kind of stuff. But with Embiid on the floor, I think he's a little bit more enthusiastic of a three-point shooter than his performance this year has indicated, though you could argue that in the long game, if this was below his expected value, that it'll work out. And Whiteside just, he makes them so much, makes Miami so much more predictable and defensible offensively, because if you give the ball to him on a post-up, you pretty much know what's going to happen, and he's not, doesn't have great vision to pass out of it, and he sulks when he doesn't get the ball very often, so it gives them, Miami, more predictability on offense, which I don't think helps them.
I'd rather see the offense go primarily through Goran Dragic than Whiteside.
And I think part of the other reason why this series is so hard to get a read on is that a lot of the players in it are inconsistent. I mean, Simmons has played really, really well the last couple weeks/months. Embiid, when he's on the floor, but, you know, Wade can have clunkers. Simmons can have those as well. Goran Dragic has even had some weird ones too. So,
I mean, game one certainly was for him, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So there will be people who step up. There will be people who disappoint, but it's always hard. It's just hard to get a read on it. And I guess that's part of the reason I'm enjoying this series. But at the same point, I like it when you can kind of get a sense of like, oh, look for this. And with this series, I just don't know what that is.
It feels like there's lots of twists and turns ahead. And I agree with, you know, what you said at the start, that I think to introduce your pre-series pick, that I think this is going to be a long series.
Plenty more to talk about with Kevin Pelton. But first, a message from TrueCar. If you're looking to buy a car, you are probably familiar with terms like MSRP. You might even know what it stands for, but what does it actually mean? The same goes for invoice, list price, and dealer price. It is enough to confuse anybody. All you are really looking for is a price that actually means something. Introducing True Price from True Car. Now you can know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, before you even get to the dealership. True Car dealers will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of home. And how do you know if your true price is a great price? Because True Car shows you what other people paid for that same car you want. And your certified dealers know this, so they set their true price competitively so they can win your business. So, when you're ready to buy a new or a used car, visit True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. Let's go on to, I believe all the other five series are all 2-0, right?
Yep.
And I think because there's a good reason to. So there are really, to me, two series that you could argue are most competitive of those 2-0 series. And I would understand that the logic of going with Celtics-Bucks as the more competitive of that is because most of us, I would say almost all of us, would say that given the injuries that Boston is dealing with, the Bucks are the more talented team in this series. Talent is a somewhat, it's not a valueless concept, but it is, you know, and that's part of the story of the series. But also because, unlike Portland, New Orleans, the team that is trailing 2-0 in this series is going home.
Exactly, and that makes a huge difference. You know, I mean, the percentages are actually very similar, but in terms of the importance of Game 3 in particular and just the direction the series can go, my main logic for putting Portland, New Orleans behind Boston, you know, Milwaukee, to just kind of get into that before we specifically discuss that series is, look, when the higher seed goes down 3-0 and has to play Game 4 on the road, that can become a slog. That can really get away from them. The series in particular I think of is the Toronto Washington series in, what was that, 2015, 2014, where Kyle Lowry was banged up and they lost the first two at home and then lost, I think, game three. And those three games were all pretty close, similar to the first two games in Portland, New Orleans. But then after that, they just clearly gave up the ghost in game four and got blown out.
Yeah, I believe that was 2015, but I'm not rigid on it. But yeah, that I think that's a part of the logic as well. And also, you know, the idea of kind of gravity in this series. And going to Bucks Celtics, I've been trying to think of the right analogy for this because one of the things Nate and I get a lot on Dunked On is the idea of, oh, if you just replaced X coach at this point, oh, all these problems are going to be solved. And the analogy that I came up with today, and it's imperfect, but let's say you were living in Chicago and you were trying to go on a family trip and you just, and let's say it's a four-member family, and three of the people wanted to go to Disney World in Orlando, and then the other people, you know, the other one person, but that's the controlling person, whatever gender they are, says, no, we're going to Disneyland in California. Well, the other three people might be mad about the decision, and let's say you're a day and a half into the trip, and you're driving over there, and you change their mind. Well, there's only so much you can do, because you already went down the road that far, so you can either give up more time to turn around and go the other direction, or you just have to make a new decision, given the constraints that you already have. And that's where I feel the Bucks are this year. They just can't solve all of the problems they have, though I think they can do a whole hell of a lot better of a job of handling the parts of this that Prunty can do.
It's interesting. I was talking to a person in the NBA at the Nike Hoop Summit last week in Portland, and their position was they figured that, you know, assuming there is a new coach next season for the Bucks, that a lot of these same problems that people have lamented this year were going to continue to plague them even with another coaching change, because of the fact that they were more structural in terms of the roster and in particular their weakness at center than were really about the coaching maneuvers.
That is both interesting and disconcerting, and I don't doubt it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how strongly I feel about it, but I certainly see that path where, you know, there's some time. I mean, it's sort of what we've seen with the coaching change from Kidd to Prunty, and maybe again it is because of the fact that it's too late and you'd need a full training camp and a chance to really plot out these changes and not do them on the fly. But I think it's also possible that as much as they've tried to do things differently than Kidd, Prunty, you know, and his coaching staff are still facing the same sort of limitations in terms of personnel that existed under Kidd. And you do see that in this series. I mean, that's why it was so fascinating to see them finally go to Giannis at center late in game one, a lineup that yielded terrific results offensively and predictably poor defensive rebounding.
And there are trade-offs involved in that. It's not like Milwaukee's a great defensive rebounding team anyway, so you can give it that sacrifice. And Tony Snell in particular, I don't know why I always focus on him being a bad defensive rebounder, but he is. And there's been some drama today with Jabari Parker complaining about not playing enough minutes. And a good place for him to start is play better. I mean, watching him in game two, and I mean, he got blown by a bunch by Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum in game one. What is the affirmative case for playing him more at this point? And you could say, oh, well, he's disheartened and that's maybe why he's not playing well. But coaches have to play the hand they're dealt, and maybe there were things that could have been done early in the season that would be better. That might have been part of the reason Jason Kidd was fired. But Jabari Parker has not deserved more minutes than he has received.
Jabari Parker in this series has a minus 8.3 PER through two games.
Whee!
Oh boy, that's very bad. Yeah, I think it's too late, and it seems like this situation is heading towards Jabari Parker finding a new team this summer, whether it's via sign and trade or just signing somewhere outright as a restricted free agent and the Bucks not matching. So, yeah, I think at this point you got to try and win the games, and you can't be worried about keeping Jabari Parker happy.
And we've seen such good success this year with Giannis playing the four defensively. I just think he's better suited for it, and threes are more valuable than fours for a lot of reasons, one being positional scarcity. So it would be a luxury for Milwaukee to be able to give Giannis that many minutes at power forward. But, you know, Chris Middleton's had a really nice year. Tony Snell is more of a two than a three, but I think Middleton can do a good enough job there. And maybe if the Bucks concentrate their resources more, either through that possibility of a sign and trade with Jabari or just the mid-level exception, they now have their draft pick for this year, something like that, on a three, because this whole team makes a lot more sense that way. And it's like one of those things that's just so hard with the Bucks is you see these flaws and you go, well, they should be better. And it's kind of the other parallel to that is playing Tyler Zeller, who I just don't think is very good. But then you go, well, what could they be doing better? And you could say in the long term, oh, defensively switching more, not gambling as much, staying solid, all those sorts of things are there. But in terms of their rotation, other than going small more often, which I fully believe they should do, I think that should be not a break glass in case of emergency. It should be closer to their default, especially because their centers aren't that good. But It's not like Thon Maker had such a good year that it's just an absolute travesty that he's not playing. He was pretty bad, and so that's why Zeller got the opportunity in the first place.
And it's also not like they've got a bunch of great wings that you would put on the court if you did go small. I mean, that's been part of the issue in this series, too. Tony Snell has a 28.6 true shooting percentage. Eric Bledsoe, who inevitably is going to play extended minutes because he was great for them during the regular season, at least offensively, has a 40.6% true shooting percentage. Now, that's counteracted by the fact that Giannis and Chris Middleton and John Henson have been so efficient in this series so far. But part of what Milwaukee needs is their guys who are important just need to play better. And I think they will play better at home. I mean, I think this is the series that I consider most likely of the 2-0 series to go back to game five tied 2-2.
One other adjustment that I would like to see Milwaukee make, and this, again, it's based partially on things that we can't see, but I thought Matthew Dellavedova looked pretty good out there on the floor, and his willingness to just get into stuff, I think, could be very useful against Terry Rozier, who has had a very nice series. I think a lot of the Boston guys, like, that's the other takeaway for me so far, is I said before that Boston has to look at this playoff run very, very differently than they probably would have, definitely than they would have in October, but even very differently than they would have before Kyrie Irving's injury. And it's more for signs of what these players can do moving forward. And I would say through two games, the returns on their young players, and Al Horford, I think Horford is a different case because he's so much more of a proven commodity, but Rozier, Brown, Tatum, I would say all of those guys have succeeded even beyond my expectations.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure that's going to be sustainable for them offensively. Certainly, I don't think they're going to win a game where they give up, you know, 64% effective shooting, which was the best by a playoff loser in the basketball reference database back to 1984. But so far, so very, very good from the Celtics young players.
So you said that you think this is the most likely series to go back 2-2. I would agree with that. But is that what you see as the expected result? Or I'm thinking it'll be 3-1.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the 3-1 is certainly the most common result, or and the average result. But I think 2-2 is more likely than 4-0.
Yeah, I mean, I could see the Bucks just totally losing steam if they lose game 3. That sort of a circumstance, not having the dead cat bounce of saying we want to move forward with it. But again, I don't know how to predict this Bucks team. I've been awful at it for a lot of this year, even though I think I did get their over-under right. Kudos to me, I guess. But let's move on to Portland, New Orleans. This was the series I had the most trouble predicting because I saw positive cases for both sides. And we've definitely seen the positive case for the New Orleans Pelicans. Drew Holiday has, to me, been the best player in the series. Both ends, domination, really good. I mean, defensively, game one was just an absolute masterpiece. Did a really nice job in game two as well. And then Anthony Davis has been very good as well. It's not killing him to say that Drew Holiday's been better. It's just that Drew's been great. And yep, tied in with Drew Holiday, I would say overall, both Lillard and CJ McCollum have performed below their expected level in this series. And it is yet another reminder, this has been true for Portland for the last 2 years in the playoffs, they depend so much on those two guys because they don't really have any other engines offensively. They have other guys who could take advantage of opportunities. Aminu had that big run in game two. Harkless played really, really well. But it really, offensively for them, does go to Lillard and McCollum are going to take them as far as they can go.
Well, Lillard and McCollum are certainly creating a lot of opportunities with the way New Orleans is defending them. And that's where I think that, you know, the two things that have happened in this series are, number one, that even relative to the way they've been defended, Lillard and McCollum have been quite good enough offensively. And particularly in game two, it seemed like Lillard had some looks there and just didn't make them. They were maybe a little bit different than the looks he normally gets. There was like some 20-foot jumpers he rarely tends to take because usually he'll either drive all the way to the basket or shoot the pull-up three. But, you know, shots that certainly should be and typically are makeable for him and just didn't go down. And then the other element is just those other guys not doing well enough with the opportunities they had. But, you know, offensively, until the last couple of minutes, Portland got back on track in game two because of the fact that Aminu played so well, because of the fact that Harkless came in off the bench and went 5 for 5. This game was lost for them at the defensive end of the court with their inability to stop Drew Holiday and then just some terrific shot making by the Pelicans, perhaps no more so than Nikola Mirotic throwing in a rainbow three-pointer to give the Pelicans the lead for good after Harkless had just made a three at the other end.
Yeah, and that was, I believe, after Mirotić, it looked like he'd sprained his ankle. And so I kind of sitting there like he wasn't moving well, and you're like, oh, man, he's been such an important part in defensively. And then he hits that shot. And also, I think Mirotić has been underappreciated in terms of the significance defensively, because his primary assignment has been Jusuf Nurkić when Nurkić has been on the floor. And Mirotić has done a good enough job that Anthony Davis can fulfill other responsibilities. And Davis is far better as a freelancer than Mirotić is, so the Pelicans are getting some real benefits there.
I think everyone assumes that Mirotić is this poor defender because of, you know, the European bias.
Sure.
and then what a good shooter he is. But, you know, he's not afraid to mix it up defensively.
Yeah, and Nurkić has done such a nice job over the course of this year, something paralleling his former teammate Nikola Jokic, of attacking mismatches, and that can be getting into position, that can be drawing fouls, a lot of different elements. But he hasn't done as much of that through two games of this series, and that could end up, it's never going to be the central point of Portland's offense, but going back to that game that they played against Houston, I think it was about 2 weeks before the end of the regular season, might have been a little bit before that. If they can get an extra, you know, 6 points on those sorts of mismatches, force a switch, just have Nurkić back that guy down, that can be a nice little basis for them to have this moving forward. And I've also been surprised, though I understand elements of it, of why Connaughton has played a lot more than Shabazz Napier. Napier, his role is marginalized because he's more valuable on ball to me than off. And so Connaughton, you know, slides the other way, and you want your best players to be ball dominant here. But I think the biggest benefit for the Blazers, assuming Harkless is ready to play, not more minutes because he played plenty of minutes in game two. It seemed like he had a minutes limit around 20, and then he ended up playing 27. But shifting Harkless to the starting lineup and Evan Turner to the second unit, I think that balances Portland's strengths and weaknesses a lot better, because Turner just wasn't providing much value in the starting five.
I mean, you know, the Pelicans were happily helping off of him, and he just couldn't make them pay. Missed all six of his shots in game two. The Blazers were minus 16 with him on the court, and, you know, that reflected what it felt like with him out there, that things just made more sense with Harkless on that weak side as the open shooter that, you know, is getting looks when they have to bring two to the ball and then a third defender over to deal with Nurkić as the role man. So, I mean, I think that will be one adjustment. We'll see whether Turner plays at all. He has the toe contusion that has his status uncertain for game four. And if he doesn't go, then certainly I think, you know, Connaughton ends up sliding more to the three than the two. And that probably opens up some minutes for Napier at point guard as a result of that. To go back to Nurkić, I mean, the fascinating thing is, like, he's got such a reputation as a bruiser and is willing to play that way. But then he's got this incredibly frustrating tendency to not finish strong, but instead try to finesse up a little floater or a hook around the basket, something like that. And I think this has been the case going back to since he came into the league in Denver, which is part of the reason he was an inefficient scorer during his time with the Nuggets. He's going to need to be more aggressive, you know, in this series when he is all alone around the basket, because of the fact that, you know, New Orleans has sent both of the defenders in the pick and roll at Damian Lillard.
So I guess the next thing to ask in this series is the same thing we just talked about with Bucks Celtics, and that is, after these two games in New Orleans, what do you think is the most likely series split?
Yeah, I mean, as we discussed earlier, I think if the Blazers go down 3-0, it's going to be very difficult for them to win. So the chance of a sweep is, I think, likelier here than it is with Milwaukee. I also think the chance that this, in some ways, the chance of the split might be higher, because if the Blazers can get game three, then, you know, all of a sudden they're in reasonable shape. They're no longer in the terrible shape that they look like now. And the fact is, these two games have been incredibly competitive. They've both been, you know, this ended up, a 9-point differential at the end of game two, but, you know, it was a 1-point game with a minute and a half left when Jrue Holiday hit the pull-up 3-pointer that, you know, real, or 2-point game, I guess, at that point, that really put the Blazers in dire straits in this one. So they were right there. And I think you can argue that, you know, again, Portland was unfortunate in terms of its shot making in game one. New Orleans was fortunate in terms of its shot making in game two. And then if that ever evens out and the Blazers end up on the right side of the shot making distribution, that they can, you know, certainly win even on the road.
I agree with your premise that both of those are more likely, but I still think that it's going to be 3-1.
Yeah.
Because the nature of these two teams, I think they're very even. I also think home court matters less in this series than before. I mean, the role players, you know, that's kind of the old chestnut is that role players play better at home. Well, both these series are very dependent on their stars. And so I think those guys will be fine. They've been through, granted, Drew Holiday was hurt the last time the Pelicans went through it. They've been through the Crucible before. Both coaches have been through all this before. So I just think these teams are really close. Portland didn't get a few bounces, and New Orleans most certainly did. And New Orleans deserves an immense amount of credit for making the most of their opportunities. I mean, Drew Holiday's been superhuman so far. He's been one of the best players in the entire playoff so far.
Yep.
And all that counts, and Davis could certainly be even better than he has been, but so can Portland. So yeah, my gut is that this is going to be 3-1, but the three different outcomes are all surprisingly close in this one.
Before we move on, can I complain about one thing about the whole Drew Holiday two-way player talk?
You can complain about as many parts of it as you want. I hate the term.
Me too, as do I, because it's two words too many, because when you say best two-way player, you should... What people actually mean is most complete two-way player, not best two-way player, because you're not counting them as equally important. You're just figuring out where players
are. You know who the best two-way guard is this year? James Harden. He's the MVP of
exactly.
the league.
But here's the really annoying thing about the two-way player talk. Like, Elvin Gentry keeps saying, like, you know, and I understand there's a lot, you know, I understand what's going on here, but he keeps talking about Holiday being one of the best two-way players in the league. He isn't the best two-way player on his own team. Like, Anthony Davis exists, people.
Yeah, and Anthony Davis's defense this year has been underappreciated. And
like, not that Anthony Davis needs more compliments. He's doing fine in that regard. But that's irking me lately.
I completely understand. I mean, and coaches have a very complicated job, especially in terms of their public communications.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it is a little bit ridiculous. And I hate the term, just generally speaking. Also, it's one of it provides very little value, and it is so frequently misused. So it's like, it doesn't, you know, so what is your threshold? Because it certainly doesn't have to, like, do you have to be an above average defensive, above average on both ends of the floor? Do you have, because it's just stupid. I hate it. I wish nobody used it. It doesn't provide any value.
It's probably not going away anytime soon.
Oh, hell no. It's not going away at all. So I think there's a pretty big line of separation between those two series and the three that we have remaining, which we will not spend nearly as much time on. And the process here in terms of figuring out competitiveness or however you want to see it, I think it kind of goes into a couple different boxes. And you can look at the quality of the top seed. You can look at the quality of the lower seed and also how they have played. And I think this is what the kind of the frame that makes this so weird. To me, Minnesota is pretty clearly, in the abstract, the best of these three teams, meaning Washington, Minnesota, and San Antonio in their current iteration. Minnesota has not been the best of those three teams through two games.
No. And that may say something about Houston, which,
sure.
I mean, just if you knew that the Rockets were going to shoot as poorly from three as they have in the first two games, I think you would figure there's a pretty good chance the Timberwolves stole one of those two on the road. You certainly would not think that they were down 20 for basically the entirety of the fourth quarter in one of them, which proved to be the case last night in game two. And that's discouraging because you have to assume that Houston is going to start shooting better at some point in this series.
Yeah, I mean, the gravity of what Houston can do. I mean, they got 52 threes up in this game, and they didn't make nearly as many of them as they could have. Chris Paul and James Harden have not played... they haven't shot well in the same game. Actually, I mean, I don't think Chris Paul played particularly well in game one. And then, so you have that series, and Minnesota, they absolutely can win a game, maybe two in that series, but I feel pretty confident they're not going to win it. You know, they're not going to win the series overall unless something drastic happens, like somebody gets hurt or anything like that. You know, there's the any chance rule, I think, still does apply to this series. I think it still applies to all these series, barely. But the most disheartening one for me has been Washington-Toronto, because even though Toronto had this wonderful season, beyond their history of never winning game one, you know, with Washington, you could see some threads of, okay, you know, they got John Wall back. Satoransky still had a wonderful season. They can make this work. They have better guard depth than before. They have enough forwards, you know, they could go in all these directions. And I mean, when you look up discouraging in an NBA dictionary, it's probably going to be the Bucks that come up, but Washington is a real close second.
That's a good question to ponder. Yeah, I mean, the other aspect you left out is just Washington's history of playing better in the playoffs than in the regular season. And so you figured if there's anyone you don't want to see if you're the Raptors in the first round, it's this Wizards team that is going to come swaggering in there. The only thing they need to qualify as the classic team that gives the Raptors trouble in the playoffs is Paul Pierce. So for them to go down so meekly, and maybe it was just a case that Toronto needed to win a game one and get that whole weight and, you know, pressure lifted off their shoulders. And once they've done that, the Raptors will be fine going forward.
Since I'm thinking about it right now, I'm going to ask you a totally unfair question.
Okay.
Who is the most likely team to win the Eastern Conference right now, 1:25 p.m. Pacific time on Thursday?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Toronto at this point because the reasons I was concerned about Toronto going into the playoffs haven't really shown up, and the reasons I was concerned about Cleveland going into the playoffs have shown up so far. And if you balance those out, I mean, Toronto was so, so much better during the regular season. I think at this point you should say the Raptors. And also the one big factor in that being there's a chance the Cavs don't get to that series in the next round. The chances of the Raptors not getting in there are in any chance territory.
Yeah, I think that's a fair conclusion to make. It still makes me queasy because right. Betting against LeBron James. But, I mean, Indiana, we both picked it as the most competitive series right now. Indiana's played really well, and there isn't anybody on the other side of the bracket that has really impressed. And whoever, theoretically, if any team steps up in that Boston, Milwaukee, Philly, Miami mix, they could get an easier path to the conference finals than either Toronto or Cleveland. But nobody has. And my expectation is that nobody will, at least not until the end of the second round. Maybe then whoever makes it out will look a lot better. But I think they'll just get steamrolled because the other two teams have higher ceilings. But yeah, I think that's a tough place to be. And okay, so let's do this. Let's talk about these last three series in the same way that we just did before. Most likely outcome, let's start with Washington-Toronto. My instinct is that Washington pulls one of these two games, even though I've been discouraged by them, you know, especially just getting run off the floor in game two the way that they did. My instinct is that it's a gentleman's sweep of sorts, but maybe the game that they win is game three.
I think it probably has to be because, you know, you look at the Wizards, their chemistry issues all season long. This feels like a team that could come apart if they lose game three.
And it would also totally fit in with the Wizards. I mean, because we get Nate and I doing the Twitter NBA show the way we have, we've gotten a lot of this. Well, how do you break up the Wizards? And my answer is that you can't really. I mean, they don't have John Wall can't be traded until I think it's around September. Bradley Beal has been important for them. He's not irreplaceable, but very hard to replace given his talent level. Otto Porter's contract isn't too desirable. Their big men aren't on really favorable contracts. So what would be kind of the most Wizards solution here is they have this offseason where they have this playoffs where it kind of breaks apart at the seams, but only moves on the margins happen. And that would be a little bit ridiculous, but also a very reasonable outcome here.
I can't remember who tweeted it. I think it might have been C-Rat, that the Wizards need a culture reset like the Raptors had last year.
Yeah, I don't think they can hire Dwayne Casey.
that would be difficult. But yes, if they can do something similar, that would be very useful for them.
Okay, so do you agree with me then, or do you think 4-0 is more likely than 3-1?
I'll go 3-1 by a hair.
Okay. Do you feel more confident that Houston-Minnesota will be 3-1, or do you think it's about the same?
I think I would say the most likely outcome in there is a sweep.
Yeah, I'd say that's most likely. I could certainly see Minnesota taking one game, but I mean, Minnesota's offense in especially the second and third quarters, but it wasn't great in the first quarter anyway, in game two was just awful. Like, they weren't getting much going on. They weren't exploiting what Houston, because Houston, their defense is so predictable, and I don't mean that in a negative way. It's really worked for them this year, that you're sitting there going, okay, well, this is what they're going to do. Before the series, you have a couple days of planning, and you go, this is the best way to attack it. And Minnesota has just looked so lost despite that I've been very, very frustrated.
Understandably so. I mean, there's not a lot to feel good about the performance. I guess Derrick Rose's game one is what you've got.
Yeah, not him getting blocked three times in a row in game two.
No, No, definitely not that.
Well, maybe you could get excited because maybe the Rockets were so excited by Gauthier's performance that maybe they'll give him regular rotation minutes, and maybe that'll be a way in for Minnesota.
That would increase this ranking in the watchability rankings if Gauthier were to become a regular.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And then the last series we have to talk about, you had it last in competitiveness, and it's going to change based on the really sad news on Wednesday that Aaron Popovich has passed away. And I mean, I think the on-court dynamics of this series have been pretty subtle. I thought San Antonio did a much better job in Game 2. They just got run off the floor in Game 1. That was shocking to see how badly they played. And I think Game 2 was more reflective of it. But what has to be concerning for San Antonio is a lot of things went their way other than the three-point shot. And yet they, you know, I would say overall, the Warriors aren't going to expect Draymond Green to get in foul trouble as early as he did, all those kind of things. And yet the Warriors still won the game eventually, maybe not comfortably, but they won it pretty convincingly.
I think it was pretty comfortable. I don't think they were working up a great sweat in terms of, you know, whether they're going to win the game in the fourth quarter. And yeah, I mean, our buddy Ethan Strauss, and how awesome it is to hear him doing podcasts again and on Twitter. Both of those places referred to the chasm in talent between these two teams. And I like the reply from someone that it was actually a Silicon Valley of talent difference between the two teams. And they're just, whoever is coaching the team, who's now going to be Ettore Messina in Game 3, with Pop understandably taking the game off after the tragic news about his wife. There's just not a good solution in terms of what you do with one of those spots on the court, because either, you know, you got DeJounte Murray out there to provide the size and great defense he's offered this season, but then there's very little in the way of floor space, especially if he plays with Kyle Anderson, which, you know, who also didn't play very much in Game 3. Or you're going with lineups where you are very limited defensively on the perimeter, with only Danny Green really as a capable perimeter defender. So something has got to give there at one of the two ends.
Yeah, and I think with this series, it's in any chance territory, but we know the outcome. I could certainly see it going five games, but it would be surprising to me if it went beyond that.
Same here, yeah. And yeah, I mean, I feel like maybe the Spurs' best chance of pulling out one of these two games is a throwback Manu performance like we saw a couple times in the last week of the regular season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that. And Manu, this was a point that Mike Prada brought up during Game 1, that their best option to run the most basic action in modern NBA, a spread pick and roll, is a 40-year-old. And that is not exactly a great place to be.
Oh, I mean, Patty Mills. He can do it. Yeah. The series, it has a feel of similar to that Houston Golden State first round a couple years ago, with the difference being that if the Spurs do manage to hit a game-winning shot to extend the series, I suspect their bench would be a little happier about it.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Oh, man. So anything else you think? I mean, we talked about all these series, went through it, but are there any other kind of like broad scope things or anything you think that we missed that we should – that are a part of the conversation at this Game 2 juncture?
I think we've mostly covered it. I mean, the other thing that's just hanging out there is, when will players who are injured return? It sounds like Luke Bamute won't be out that much longer. And then, you know, Steph Curry, when that happens. But other than Embiid, it doesn't sound like any of them will affect the first round at this point.
Yeah, I think that's where we are at this moment. It can always change, but those will, you know, some dynamics will swing. I think Mbamute is extremely necessary for the Rockets in the series against the Warriors, but I think he could be important in the next round. And a point that I made in regards to the upset chances for the Rockets before the conference finals is that while whoever makes it out of the Jazz Thunder series is might be worse for wear physically, just because those teams are so big and so strong, and it's been that kind of series so far, they will have a ton of confidence, and they will be playing a strong game, because whoever wins that series is going to need that to get through it.
Yeah, they're going to have beaten a better team and just have been a better regular season team than whoever Golden State ends up facing on the other side.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Kevin Pelton for taking the time. You can, of course, read him at ESPN. You can also listen to the fabulous Pelton cast that he does, which I really enjoy. And you can follow him on Twitter, at KPelton, KPELTON. he is just such an amazing workhorse in terms of getting material, thoughtful, intelligent, worthwhile out during the playoffs. I try to think of myself as somebody who produces a lot as well, but KP is at a whole different level, and I read everything he does for a good reason, because it is worth reading. And so I highly recommend you do the same. And this is going to be a fascinating week or so of NBA basketball. I mean, what happened after we recorded was, I think, the most notable outcome beyond Joel Embiid returning and, you know, having some really nice moments in Philadelphia's win, was New Orleans just absolutely taking a stranglehold on their series against the Portland Trailblazers. And so looking like we're going to get Warriors-Pelicans in the second round, pretty excited about that, but still plenty of time and space for all these series to move around. So I'm incredibly excited to see where the playoffs go the next little bit. It's a little bit of a stable time. Those of you who listen to the San Vicini podcast last week, this will be a little bit of a quieter time in terms of the draft. And I am thinking about the offseason already, because I am already starting my offseason previews, which will come out this year at The Athletic. I do all 30 teams in depth. The first ones, that the first drafts of them, are between 1,200 words and 1,500 words, which is probably going to be my standard for every team. So you can look forward to those coming in the weeks and 2 months to come, because I like to have them all out before everything gets real crazy before July 1st, so people can process it. So those are in the works. Very excited about that. And then lots of other stuff, of course. Twitter NBA show going super strong this year. We're basically going every single day. The Warriors do not have a home game, and love doing it so far. The feedback has been good. That's on Periscope. You can check that out. It's basically watching the games with Nate Duncan and me. Really do enjoy it. And then Dunked On, 5 times a week, just like normal. My own work is wherever it shows up. Real GM is going to have some stuff. I'm actually working on, in my head, a series of pieces. I'm hoping to have 2 of them out next week, which will be, if I can actually pull it off, would be something I've been asked to do a lot. And if I can get it done in written form, that would be fantastic. And then that also might end up being a Danny story time for Patreon, patreon.com/DuncanLaRue. Great way to support the Twitter NBA show, because we are not ad supported at this moment. So if you have any feedback on this show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. I might not respond. I have a lot of stuff to go through, but I do read it because it is very important to me. And if you like the show, awesome. Great to spread the word however you see fit. But a very important part of that is leaving a rating, leaving a review in the podcast player of your choosing. But it's great if it's Apple, because they're just so big in the business. And just spreading the word, telling people, hey, if you're on social media, if you Reddit, whatever it is, hey, you should listen to either Real Jam Radio in general or this specific episode. Really do appreciate it. And then subscribing and downloading every episode. Real Jam Radio is different than a lot of shows, that it does not have a specific release date, because to get the right guests for me, you have to be flexible. And so with KP, with this one, we wanted to do Thursday, because that's when all the game twos had been done. And so some weeks it'll be then, some weeks it'll be other times. And if you want to hear me do something different, I had a really fun time. I was on Shaq's podcast, The Big Podcast with Shaq, and I did a playoff preview of sorts with him that I really enjoyed, and it was such a thrill for me to be on the air with him. And hopefully we get to do it again soon. That is a part of the Podcast One family. You can also check out the Attack Every Day podcast from the Harbaugh family. And the other big thing you can do to support this show and any others is check out our sponsors, Simple Contacts. Really just amazing service to save a bunch of time and ideally save a bunch of money as well. 5-minute eye test, very, very cool. And you can go to simplecontacts.com/realgm, or you can enter the Real GM promo code. Both things, same discount, get you $30 off your contacts. So convenient, 5-minute test, don't have to go into a doctor's office, all that kind of stuff. Really, really awesome. And then TrueCar, great place to buy new and used cars. I can talk. You can check that out. So happy to have them as a sponsor as well. That is enough for now. Thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.